More now on what role corporate directors might play to prevent corporate fraud. Charles Elson is the director of the Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. He's in New York City today and joins us by phone. Professor Elson, I'd like to ask you, from what you heard President Bush say today, what might he have said about the role of directors that might have changed things at all?
Well, I think the most important issue vis-a-vis directors and corporate fraud is the activity level of the board of directors itself. The secret is to have an active monitoring board. An active monitoring board, in my view, does two things. Number one, it creates accountability of the CEO to the board and to, obviously, the shareholders. And number two, within the organization itself, it creates a culture where if there is a problem, people are willing to come forward, and hopefully you catch fraudulent activity a lot earlier than you do under present circumstances.
When we hear about what happened at WorldCom, for example, what responsibility do WorldCom's directors, as opposed to WorldCom's officers, bear for what happened?
Well, the question is, what red flags were presented to the board? Did they have an inkling of what was going on? If the answer is no, they bear little responsibility, except, I guess, in the broadest sense, if a culture was created that allowed that sort of thing to happen. On the other hand, if there were red flags present, that becomes a different story. The question is, how large were the flags? How obvious were they? And if they were presented with warning signals, did they follow through properly?
I've heard the proposal made very often over the past couple of weeks that boards, and President Bush, I believe, restated this, boards should be majority outside directors, not managers. The audit committee, the compensation committee should be composed of outside directors. I went back to the April 2002 proxy statement of WorldCom. 7 out of 11 directors are outsiders. The compensation committee is 3 directors, all of them outside directors. The audit committee is 4 members, all outside directors. There's some upstanding citizens there, a law professor, people knowledgeable in related businesses. By structure, that board seemed to be fine.
Well, the question is, who is independent and who is not? One doesn't have to be an employee of the company and an outsider simply to be independent. What independence means is there should be no financial connection between that director and the company whatsoever, other than long-term equity ownership. Any other kinds of financial linkages become problematic.
But let me ask you this, though. I looked up the proxy statements of 5 corporations, yep. None of them notorious in this year's Wall Street scandals,
yeah.
On which one individual sits as a director, retired diplomat with a university professorship, whom I'll call Ambassador D here.
Okay.
And I tried to figure out, what does Ambassador D make for being a director? I couldn't calculate some of the stock option grants, and I don't know how many meetings he attended and their fees per meeting, but I figure he makes at least $320,000 for doing that. Why would someone with that job of going to a couple of dozen meetings a year ever rock the boat with any corporation?
Well, that's why, in addition to independence, you've got to have equity ownership. You've got to link the director's financial fortunes to the company and not to the management. In other words, if that director held a substantial amount of company stock, the consequences of not rocking the boat would be to affect that director personally, financially. Independence gives you objectivity, but it's substantial equity ownership that gives the director the incentive to exercise that objectivity.
So you're saying that the corporate director should not be sitting there as public citizen, bringing concern for the greater good to this otherwise parochial group of people, but he should be parochial in a healthy way, saying, I'm a big-time stockholder here.
That's right. I'm representing the interests of my fellow shareholders. And historically, traditionally, that's who directors were. They were simply representatives of the shareholders. They typically were the larger shareholders because they had more to lose. In the 1920s, with the growth of the size of our companies, shareholdings became atomistic, and no one shareholder had enough to put their people on the board. Management came in and filled that vacuum by appointing directors. And that's how we ended up in the pickle we're in today. It's historic.
Well, then why does everyone who approaches this issue seem to stop short of saying, let's get the CEO off the board and not make him the chairman? Why don't people see the virtues of having a real firewall between those who are the board and those who are the managers of the
corporation?
Well,
I think that historically the evolution of the CEO on the board dates back, again, to the 20s. And to, at this point, take the CEO off the board completely, unless everyone did it, as effectively a slap in the face of the CEO, which may make the CEO's authority within the organization slightly problematic. On the other hand, it's not a terrible idea because management obviously works for the board, who is there for the shareholder benefit. I don't see any harm, frankly, in having the CEO on the board. I think that what I do see as problematic is where you have a board that is dominated by members of management rather than the independent directors, because at that point, the board simply becomes a rubber stamp of management initiative and is no longer a monitor, kind of like the parsley on the fish, if you will. Looks good, but doesn't do very much.
Professor Elson, thank you very much for talking with us. Charles Elson, who's the director of the Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware.